ready for the run.
Well, to revert back to the employment, there's the government, such as they have the post office, the RCM police, the meteorological station, forestry. They were federal government. I don't know whether I think they're territorial now. They were federal then. And then you have the territorial government, which has the education, you know, schools and the teachers and the liquor store and the territorial agent, the welfare, and possibly a few others that I can't remember right offhand. That is, there's quite a number of people involved in that, because it's a service area for that will take in, we'll say, about 100 miles, 150 miles south, or right up to the, about 120 miles south, and then right up to the border, and then right up to the Beaufort Sea. Mm-hmm. And, well, that's about the extent of it, because I think it cuts off someplace up in Stewart River, or past that, you see, which is way out in the wilderness.
Back to your service on the... Did you call it the? Did you call it, or do they call it in Dawson, the council, a city council?
Yes, you have the city council, and then you have the territorial council. Yeah.
So you were alderman then. How long were you alderman?
9 years.
9 years. Mm-hmm.
Approximately 9 years.
And then you to become a councillor for the territory of Yukon Territory, you had to be elected also.
Oh, yes. Same old stuff, you know, you had to battle for it.
Yeah. Who was your opponent in that race?
V.C. Miller.
V.C.
Miller? Jimmy Miller.
Jimmy Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Miller, M-E-L-L-O-R.
That's right, M-E-L-L-O-R. Mm-hmm. O-R, Miller.
And what, was it a conservative versus liberal
ticket?
Or
it was
just more?
It was nonpartisan. Absolutely nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the council has been nonpartisan for since I can remember, and is just starting to enter into it politics in the sense of a partisan politics. Let's put it that way.
Well, your territorial council now for the territory of Yukon Territory, does it have a representative from each community?
From each. Each electoral district, there are seven. When I was first there, it were five, and we asked for more say and to split up some of the inequalities that have been mm-hmm. created by this huge area. I mean, when I first came in, there were three, only three representatives, one from Mayo, one from Whitehorse, and one from
Dawson.
You see, there was no such a thing as any Alaska Highway or any of the points in between, except perhaps little trading posts.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was it. Then, of course, after the with the advent of the Alaska Highway, communities started to develop. Haynes Junction and Watson Lake and Johnson's Crossing and Burwash and Beaver Creek and so on. But they weren't in existence when I first came in. This was the large center, and between this and Mayo were the only producing areas of the Yukon.
Mm-hmm. So now it's up to
seven members.
Mm-hmm. And the capital of Yukon Territory now is Whitehorse.
Is Whitehorse, that's correct.
But and
that was changed in about 1951, 52.
Yeah, and that's when the government seat moved from Dawson City
that's
to Whitehorse.
Exactly.
And then Dawson City was required to form its own...
That's right, just prior to their leaving.
City government, mm-hmm. Yes, I see.
We objected to that violently, but the decisions were made in Ottawa.
In Whitehorse now, since it's the seat of the territorial government, does the territorial government direct the city affairs, or does the city have its own council?
No, the city, you mean the city of Whitehorse?
Yes.
No, the city of Whitehorse have their own elected civic government. The same as Dawson does.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same, except they have more aldermen and, of course, a far larger budget. I think their budget exceeds $1 million now. Far over $1 million.
While you were in the Territorial Council, were there any major pieces of legislation that affected Dawson City that you can recall. Just
well,
you must have been instrumental in some of the highway construction in this area.
Yes, quite a number of things. You know, one looks back and you can see many things. In the first instance, I was the. It took me 2 years to get the first old folks home established in the Yukon Territory, and I had a lot of opposition from the government. They thought it was a waste of money, but I used to know many of these old timers in 50 below zero. They'd be out there chopping their wood and living in little old cabins and having a hard time to get along. They were looked after by the government to a certain point. I think they got $40 a month and got their garbage and their water service. Apart from that, they had to live on their own resources, and it was pretty slim. It wasn't only that that bothered me. It was the fact that some of these poor old fellows had to go out in 50 and 60 below and split wood.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the wood was delivered to them, but it was pretty hard for many of them, and I felt that we should be able to do better than that for our pioneers, and as a result got this home started. I remember Collins was the commissioner at the time, and when I brought that up, he said, "Well, George," he says, "what the heck?" He says, "you build that." He says, "and you want to put the women and the old women and the old men in the same building?" And I said, "Why, of course." "Well," he says, "the old men will be going to the old women's rooms and so forth and whatnot." I said, "That's right, but," I said, "when they get to 70 years of age, if they want to go back and forth, why, you should be the last one to complain about it." So that was built.
Is that what you call the Sunset
Home? That's the Sunset Home.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first things that I got started in the Yukon. I was very proud of that because I thought it served a need that was desperately required.
Uh-huh.
And they were really comfortable in it. It was quite hard for some of the old-timers to adjust to something that they couldn't do exactly what they wanted to do, but they buckled down, and first thing you know, they thought it was a wonderful place. Someone looking after their needs.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
they
did, cook for them?
No, they did their own cooking.
Oh, they did their own
mm-hmm.
cooking?
They did their own cooking. They had stoves in there. In fact, it was... I wanted the rooms to be built 16 by 16, and they built them 14 by 14. I remember the cost, too. The cost was $50,000 to build that home. And that was a tremendous amount of money that the government were going to have to spend uselessly in their estimation. But, of course, we look now, and we see that that was... it wasn't a very fancy home, even at that. But it was warm, it was clean, and they had all the facilities, all the modern facilities in there. And they were really quite happy about it.
Well, now I understand that they have maid service there now.
Well, that's different. The last thing that I was able to do before I left the council was to get funds for a hospital and for what we call a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that in my arguments, in my pleas to get this money, I on many occasions quoted the Pioneer Home in Fairbanks. I had seen that.
Yeah, we had
and I said,
that.
If these people in Alaska can do that for their pioneers, we can do no less. And so they approved the money for the addition. The addition cost $650,000. That was a far cry from the $50,000 to build the original home.
Was and that a territorial appropriation, or was there federal participation?
No, there was no federal. In the sense, there is always a federal participation mm-hmm. in any money, in most money spent in the Yukon. But this was purely a territorial, under territorial jurisdiction, and they had to find the finances for it. But mind you, the finances come from what you might call a deficit grant from the federal government. In other words, if the territory can't meet essential requirements, then the federal government, in the goodness of their heart, may make what they call deficit grant.
Mm-hmm.
the hospital was strictly a federal. And I was always very much in favor of that. The territory ran their own hospitals for a long time, but the territory did not have the expertise to operate hospitals as they should be operated in relation to the standards of to federal standards. And now the federal government are operating all the hospitals in the Yukon. They operate in conjunction with the territory. The territory will pay them so much money, pay the Department of National Health and Welfare. The money for that comes from local taxation, and from what is lacking will come from a deficit grant, if it's approved.
Then I noticed coming over, and I know that there's a different concept in Canada from the Alaskan concept in opening the country. And we hear this quite often in Alaska, that Canada is far-sighted, and the government, or the territorial government, I'm not certain, probably the federal government,
federal government.
Very far-sighted and progressive in this manner. And it builds good roads into areas that are productive. For example, the Clinton Mine area. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well,
is that your policy?
I don't know the system in Alaska, although it does vary. The federal government have been really, what I would say, quite progressive in relation to the population and so on. They have been most progressive in developing main roads through the Yukon. For example, we have this road going up the Dempster. It's going up to the Arctic coast, you might say, up to Fort McPherson and Inuvik, eventually. And they are going so far each year with it. Now, the roads that we have built, all the capital expenditures in the Yukon Territory are borne by the federal government. That is a direct grant to the territory. Now, once they are built, they are then turned over to the territory, and the territory operates them. Now, there are some exceptions. For example, with roads, the federal government, when they're building a road to one area or the other, will have complete and absolute control. They'll put out the tenders and pay the money and see that the road is up to the standard in which is desired. And after that is completed, then they turn that over to the territorial government, and the territorial government then pays 15% of the costs of maintenance.
50%?
15%. The federal government pays the balance of cost of maintenance. Now, that sounds like not very much, but when you consider the road, now, I've been out of office for 2-3 years now, but just prior to leaving office, prior to retiring, the road, the maintenance costs between Whitehorse and Dawson City were about $1 million a year, close to $1 million. So that's $150,000, which the territory would have to pay, and the federal government pick up the balance.
Now, how many miles is that?
That is 340 miles we're talking about.
340 miles.
And, of course, now the costs are climbing each year as this inflationary spiral.
340 miles of gravel road is a lot of road to maintain.
Well, it is. And then, of course, they maintain this other road, too, going out to Clinton, up as far as the takeoff. Mm-hmm. Now, the road from the main road to Clinton Creek was put in by Clinton Creek, and the federal government paid, I believe, 50% of the costs of that road. But from there on, the mine, Cassia Asbestos, has to maintain that road. Well, that road isn't anything like as good as this road from here to the cutoff. But this road from the ferry, from the Dawson Ferry, to where it turns off, that's about 35 miles. That cost just about $3 million to put in. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful gravel highway.
Yes, it is.
It's super.
Wonderful.
But when you talk about Canada being far-sighted, it certainly has improved since I have been here. But I remember the time when you first connected the 60-mile road with the Alaska Highway through the Richardson Highway, mm-hmm. and we thought that was just fantastic. Now, why couldn't we have roads like that here? But you must remember that at that time we had no roads into Dawson.
Yes.
We were completely isolated. When the last boat went, that was it, except by aircraft. That's right. You took the stage or you
flew.
Or you flew or you hoofed it.
Well, we have many, many communities in Alaska still in that same position.
But the federal government, I think, have been quite far-sighted in building roads, resource roads, they mm-hmm. call them.
Resource roads.
Resource roads.
Well, in our
in
state,
the Yukon.
The reason I posed this question to you, or these questions, in our state, it seems that roads are built after a population is there. If there's a population large enough or to justify a road, mm-hmm. then it'll be built as first it starts as a trail, then it'll be mm-hmm. upgraded, and eventually, if there's a large population, it'll be paved. But in Canada, we hear people say, well, Canadians do it the other way. They build roads to encourage development.
Well,
then the population follows.
It wasn't always that way. Mm-hmm. It is that way now.
It's that way now.
For example, and I was a great advocate, building a road north and south, right through from one end of the territory to the other. And from there you can make branch roads to where development might later occur. Certainly, if there were no roads anyplace, your minerals are worthless. You can't take them up by balloon or by airplane. It's not practical. I talk about it might be at some time, but it certainly isn't practical now. So you have to have roads. Now, the Anvil Mine, they found a huge quantity of ore there. It was a massive body. So the federal government immediately got cracking on it. But they also made agreements with the Anvil Mining Corporation that they would do this in return for having this done. They would put in a bridge, and the Anvil Mining Corporation would contribute so much to something else. It's been an arrangements between private industry, or those that were interested in large mineral output, mm-hmm. and the government. And I think it's worked out very, very well in the long run. Now, of course, with mining, with the Anvil Mine, as you know, that's a pretty big mine. They also have an agreement that in so many years, and this has always been a pet theory of mine, they will, in this eight-year period, either 5 or 8 years, they will consider the feasibility of putting up a smelter. You see, if there were a smelter in the Yukon, there are many, many small mineral properties that could be profitably exploited.
Yes.
Because they could truck a short distance to the smelter and then ship out the finished product. And that's one thing I have quite strong feelings about. In Canada, we are particularly in the north, everything is brought in that's manufactured, and we are just supplying the raw materials. And one of the things that surprised me immensely was the output from Keno Hill. It didn't go to trail, it went to Tacoma to be smelted.
Oh, yes.
Whereas that could be smelted right in the Yukon. Carmax, for example, is a fairly central location, and they appear to have a coal mine there that has tens and tens and hundreds of thousands of tons of coal. Well, there is the power requirement mm-hmm. for a large smelter, and the heat. And then, of course, up north, just a little ways up the Dempster Highway, we have gas and oil. I have a bottle of oil here, the first oil that was discovered in the Yukon from the Chance Well. Now, I forget what year that was, but it was quite a number of years ago.
Is there quite a lot of oil exploration going on now in the Yukon?
Quite a bit, I believe, in the northwest section close to the...
Alaska border?
No, Northwest Territories border. And, of course, in the Northwest Territories, I was up in Inuvik last year. My God, that was just a boom town, just something like Whitehorse was when they built the Alaska Highway mm-hmm. on account of this oil exploration.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's quite a lot of ore that's going south on the White Pass Railroad now, isn't that?
There is. Well, that comes from the Anvil Mine. The Anvil Mine, I believe, is producing now. This is round figures. about 1,000 tons a day of zinc zinc and lead concentrates, which of course goes to Japan. Cassiar is producing about 300 to 350 tons a day of asbestos, which go to Vancouver from there,
the
transshipped
at
Clinton Creek. Yeah. United Keno Hill, I don't know what their production would be, but it may be, say, 75, 80 tons a day. Now, I'm not sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't producing as much as what it did produce at one time, but it's...
But it's all shipped out for smelting.
It's all shipped out. And in fact, I did hear that they had produced, this was a couple of years ago, that their silver production was on par with, at that time, with what had been produced from the Comstock Lode.
Oh, is that right?
Around, that's just outside of Reno, isn't it? Virginia City. But you don't, in this day and age, it doesn't have the same impact as what it had there.
Right.
You know, it was, silver was really worth a great deal more relatively then than it is now.
To get off the transportation for a minute and back to historical site preservation, I'm very impressed with the work I see in Dawson City on historical site preservation.
And well,
I know this is federally funded. I talked to a couple people
well,
today.
Well, it is right now, but there's a lot of preserving done locally. I have been a real nut on this, trying to bring to the people of Canada and the world in general that the Klondike Gold Rush was something of national significance. It was an era of Canadian history that was a romantic era. It wasn't a story of bloodshed and killing. It was a story of man's struggle against
the elements.
You know, some of the worst elements that you can have in North America, almost, unless you go up to the North Pole, and they overcame these things. And it was something that I, as a child, I'd heard two things about Canada in England when I was a boy. That was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Klondike Gold Rush. And I tried to impress on Ottawa for years, and many other people around Dawson did too, how important this was, but they couldn't be less interested. But now, of course, they are becoming interested, and they'll never regret it, because it is something that is really worthwhile.
You have a marvelous collection of old equipment and artifacts here in your own personal museum. Are these your own personal?
They were, yes. I turned that over to the historic sites because I wanted someone to have it that would maintain it and keep it. And they're doing a very good job on that. They have to, all those exhibits have to be painted every other year, at least. And it's quite a job. It got a little bit much to have to get out there and paint them every other year. And as a result, as you note, that fire engine is almost like new, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And that has been exposed to the weather for 40 years.
This equipment that you have in your museum park, is that what you call it? Or
yeah, I call that the... I first put that up on Bonanza Creek. But what I wanted to do was, you see, I've worked all that kind of equipment, every bit of it, except the whipsaw. I haven't worked that or the fire engine, but all the mining equipment, that self-dumper. I had one of those, I was mining one of those up on Kirkman Creek, and also the windlass. I'd mined on different creeks with a hand windlass and had to build a cabin and drag the logs from up on the side hill and so on. And I wanted people to, at the time that I put that up, there was not one self-dumping outfit operating in the Yukon Territory. In fact, there wasn't any that was standing up except this one, and it belonged to a fellow named John Risco. John Risco owned it, and it was on Hunker Creek. Him and Nell Skistat, you remember him, Adrienne?
I don't know.
That's Emma Mellor's father.
Father, oh yeah.
And they ran a roadhouse at the Arlington. So John Risco had been mining down on Silver City, and he borrowed some equipment from me, and he couldn't get it up at the time. And so I said, well, John, I said, tell you what, you keep that equipment down there. You give him that self-dumper outfit you got up there. It was the only one that was left. Mm-hmm. So he said, sure. So I went up, and I brought it down, and I set it up. So I guess it is about the only one that's set up.
How did you acquire the fire engine? Or was
that? Well, the fire engine, this happened, I didn't first acquire that, George Murdoch acquired that. And what happened there, it sat in a, it was taken from the fire hall and put in an empty lock. And it was sitting there. And George Murdoch went to see the commissioner, who gave him the fire engine. And I gave him a hand, and we got it back up here and painted it and fixed it up and polished it. And then looked after it and painted it every other year since that time. We used to have it in the parades on the 17th and fire it up. In fact, in 1960, about that time, the city of Whitehorse asked if they could borrow it for a firefighting exhibition that we're having down there. So they trucked it to Whitehorse, and the firemen there, they had much more time than I did, they had the thing running. So it's in operating condition. That's right. And it was made by the Waterers people about 1900 mm-hmm. in Waterloo, Ontario. In fact, I sent them a letter and gave them a picture of it. They were sure surprised. They said they have that up in their hall to show that their equipment is really quality material because it's still operating after 70 years.
Yeah. Well, it's encouraging to see the work that is being done in Dawson City. And I'm hoping that we can generate a little more interest in our area. Though it's growing, I think.
Well,
don't you think
what has really happened is that the government have realized what the significance of this historic era of Canada. And they are putting in, I think, about $10 or $15 million over a period of years restoring all these buildings. And they are doing it, they're very thorough. Mind you, of course, they started first with the Palace Grand. And it was the KVA, a private group, that bought that.
It's the Klondike Visitors Association.
That's right. And then later on, the museum burnt down in 1958. So there's myself and Roy Minter, Mac Monroe, and a lady who's now in Whitehorse, Iris Warner. She's a writer. What do you call them? She doesn't write for a newspaper. Freelance, yeah. And she was a terrible, tremendous worker, too, for that. And we started up the museum. I managed to get the building, the use of the building from the federal government, the old post office. We mucked it out, and we started absolutely from scratch. We didn't have a thing. When the fire hall burnt down here, the only thing that was left was the old school bell, and that had been through the fire in the school. So we started that up. And the KVA had the locomotives brought over from Lousetown, so we took them under our wing, we painted them, and we went around and we borrowed, begged and stole any artifact that we could, and that is when that was started. Two or three people started that thing, and now it's a pretty doggone good little museum.
It certainly is.
So from the...
Yeah, it is. My picture's in there twice.
Yes.
She likes it.
And we made a few dollars on it. We charged 50 cents admission, and with that we painted the locomotives.
We paid for someone to work there too, I expect.
Yes, and we paid the attendants that were there. And we bought the blacksmith shop, Billy Biggs' blacksmith shop. We bought the old post office. We gave that to the historic sites. We took a piano that used to be in the community hall, that the Eagle Hall,
uh-huh.
A beautiful grand piano. We sent that to White Horse. It cost us $1,500. We got that completely refurbished, and we presented that to the Palace Grand Theatre. So that's what the museum did in this community.
Yeah, wonderful.
And our total government assistance was the use of that building, just the use of it. We had to pay all light, water, repairs, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, we got $500 a year grant from the territorial government, and that's what we built the museum up on.
What are they going to do?
Took a lot
with
of free work.
Well, the Oddfellas Hall, what are you going to do?
I don't think that's considered an historic site.
Oh, isn't it?
No.
Carnegie Library is, though, isn't it?
Huh?
The Carnegie Library.
Oh, yes, yes.
Where the Masons were in last.
That belongs to the Masons.
Oh, that.
They want it to stay there, but they haven't taken it over. You see, they have different categories. They have buildings in which they would like to have people maintain themselves. And then there are other buildings in which they take over complete control and mm-hmm. expenditure in relation to it.
Is there any chance the Masons would restore that building?
Well, it doesn't have to be restored. It is restored.
It is.
They hold their meetings there, I believe.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, I see. It's still
beautiful
yes.
inside.
Is it?
Oh, yes. It's all finished with this this impressed tin work.
Come in. Come in.
All this fancy tin work, you know what you see in these old buildings.
Yes.
And it's
is there
beautiful.
A large Masonic order here, large enough to maintain a membership? And
well, it's a little difficult, let's say. It's not large.
Is
no.
the building heated in the winter?
No, just for meeting nights.
Just for meeting nights. Mm-hmm. That's a handsome building. Mm-hmm. The windows are boarded up outside.
That's right. Well.
That's probably for
vandals keep throwing neighbors. Rocks at it. That's why we just got tired of replacing the windows, so we got plywood and painted them and put that up.